what we're going to start with today is we'll end up with, well, thank you so much for that. Because faculty lead such important, rich lives that we don't have time to erase our own damn boards. But I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter. Anyway, I hope this isn't anyone's life work. Okay, so we talked just very briefly at the end about independent assortment and dihybrid crosses. We'll spend a little time at the beginning today showing you a few ways how to do those to be able to calculate what the outcome will be, the genotypic-phenotypic ratios, and express those either as a ratio or as percentages. Like I said, we're not going to hammer away at this as much in this class as it was done in 197, because I assume you've already done it. We're just going to shake off the rust a little bit. But there is a homework assignment that will be online about an hour after class. It's due at the beginning of class on Tuesday, and some of those points will be pretty basic problems like this. All right, so remember when we did the monohybrid cross? Oh, let me turn the lights up, sorry. Okay, so if we've got, say, two heterozygotes for a trait, and do the Punnett square of that, so with two heterozygotes, we should have a genotypic ratio of one heterozygous dominant, two heterozygotes, and one homozygous recessive. Okay? So when you do a monohybrid cross, you will always get a genotypic ratio of 1:2:1. Now, the phenotypic ratio for this is 3:1, because this homozygous dominant and the two heterozygotes will all express the dominant phenotype. That's when we have true dominance. Okay, if for some reason we're talking about an incomplete dominant system, the phenotypic ratio will always be the same as the genotypic ratio if there's incomplete dominance. We would have one red, one white, and two pinks if there's incomplete dominance. But when there's complete dominance, you add the homozygous dominant and the heterozygotes together because they will both express the dominant phenotype. Okay, so you just break down the genotype of each parent into separate alleles and put them in the box. Okay, if we've got a dihybrid cross, for now in this class, we will always assume at this level that these alleles are on separate chromosomes, that they'll assort independently of each other. And so we've got two independent events that are taking place, and so we need to draw a bigger square. It needs to be 4 by 4. And then we just need to come up with the possible gametes that each of these parents can produce with these two alleles. Okay, so in this one, if we start with the big A, then the big A could be paired with the big B. The big A could be paired with the small b here, the small a with the big B, and the small a with the small b. Okay, they're independent events, so they're not linked. So big A and big B are not always going to travel together. Okay? And then the same thing with the other parent. They're exactly the same. I'll write it like this. Okay. And then you can just go through and do the columns and rows thing again if you want to. Do. So I've just done all the columns, filled those in, and then I'll go through and add the rows. And I tend to cheat as I fill them out and try to keep the dominants first. It just makes it easier when you're going through. But if you're just doing them quickly, it doesn't matter which order they're in as long as you can recognize when you've got a heterozygote. Okay, so we now have 16 squares. That doesn't mean we have 16 different genotypes. Many of these are the same genotypes. So we could go through and find cases where we've got two of the same genotypes in there. Let's see. Like these two are the same genotypes. And so that happens throughout. The actual ratio, if you remember from, this is when similar to when Mendel did his second round of experiments, and he crossed the F1s. All of the F1s, even for two traits, were identical. And then when he crossed them, what he got was a 9:3:3:1 ratio. And so this would be dominant-dominant, dominant-recessive, recessive-dominant, and recessive-recessive. So this is the only one out of these 16 that will exhibit both recessive traits. Okay. Nine of them, let's see. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Yay! Look at that, they just don't hand those degrees out. Nine of them, sometimes they do. Sorry, if you got enough money in your pocket, you go to the right university, you too can have doctor in front of your name. And you usually get to go someplace really warm and beachy too. Nine of those genotypes will be result in dominant for both of them. Sorry, this is the phenotypic ratio. Both of them will be dominant phenotypic ratios. Three of them will be dominant for A and recessive for B. So that one, and that one. Right. Then there should be three that are recessive for A, dominant for B. Oh, and then the two that I looped over here. Okay, there's the other three, and then this is the one on its own. Okay. But again, we're really looking at two independent events with a phenotypic ratio of 3:1 that are being multiplied together. Okay. Now, if instead of sitting around and circling the genotypes that correspond to the phenotype, if we wanted to know what the genotypic ratio was of this cross, right, the 9:3:3:1 is the result of just multiplying the two phenotypic ratios of the individual crosses, A and B. Okay. If we wanted to determine the genotypic ratio of this, we do the same thing with this ratio. We multiply 1:2:1 times 1:2:1. So we multiply 1:2:1 times 1. We get 1:2:1. We multiply 1:2:1 times 2. We get 2:4:2. We multiply 1:2:1 times 1 again. 1:2:1. So the phenotypic ratio would be 9:3:3:1. The genotypic ratio is 1:2:1 to 2:4:2 to 1:2:1. And if we throw in a third trait, you could do exactly the same thing. You multiply this times 1:2:1. And each one of these numbers corresponds to a unique genotype possible. So if we just count this, we've got nine possible genotypes that are in here. We've got 4 phenotypes and 9 possible genotypes in this cross. Okay? So if you like doing Punnett squares, you can do it this way. If you just want to jump directly to the ratios, and the ratios can be converted into percentages pretty easily, right? Like if you've got a 3-to-1, that's 75 and 25%. 1-to-2-to-1 are 25, 50, and 25%. Even this one, you just add up the total. This should be 16. So each one is going to be, you know, 6.6%. 2s will be 13.2. It's pretty easy to extract the percentages from the ratios. Okay. So we'll give you some problems like that on the homework. It's up to you how to do it. But this was a dihybrid cross. Remember, the rules change when you change the actual crosses, the genotypes of the parents. And there was that table in the slides that I told you it's probably worthwhile to take a look at. So, for example, if you've got... if you have a heterozygote times a homozygous dominant, right, you've got 2 possible genotypes. Right? You can have either big A, big A, or you can have big A, little a that results in the offspring if you do this Punnett square. Way too small. So 2 possible genotypes that are in a 1-to-1 ratio for the genotypes. But the phenotypes, there's only 1 possible phenotype. All of the offspring will be exhibit the dominant phenotype. Anytime one of the parents is homozygous dominant, all of the offspring will be dominant. Okay? They're always going to get a dominant allele from that parent. The dominant allele will always mask the recessive allele. So all the offspring in this case will be dominant. So a 1-to-1 genotypic ratio, 1-to-1 phenotypic ratio. Okay, now say that we do a similar cross, but now instead of a homozygous dominant, we just do it with a homozygous recessive. We're still crossing a heterozygote with a homozygote. Right? So it may be tempting to say the same rules will apply, but they don't. If we do that cross... the genotypic ratio is still 1-to-1. Half of them are heterozygous, half of them are homozygous. But now the phenotypic ratio is also 1-to-1. Because these two will exhibit the recessive phenotype, these two will exhibit the or express the dominant phenotype. So even though we're both cases we're crossing a heterozygote times a homozygote, the fact that it's dominant in this case, recessive in this case, makes a big difference in the ratio. So take a look at that slide if you want the shortcuts. This ratio, genotypic ratio, is always going to be 1-to-1. The phenotypic ratio is always just going to be 1, you know, that there is no second phenotype. This one is always going to be 1-to-1. Phenotypic ratio is always going to be 1-to-1. Monohybrids are always going to be 1-to-2-to-1. Genotypic ratio, 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. And so you could skip doing the Punnett square if you memorize those ratios and just get comfortable multiplying those out. So as I mentioned, you're going to have a few fairly basic problems based on genotype, phenotype, and the homework, again, it's online on the class webpage. If you haven't found the class webpage yet, you probably should be doing that. And it will be worth 5 points. And as a reminder again, there will be 12 assignments throughout the semester. We take your 10 highest grades. So if you forget to do one and you come to class, don't get all panicky and ask me for extra time. You just get to drop that one. Okay. Okay. And then today we're going to start talking about sex determination. And gender can be determined by a lot of different factors. Many of them are genetic, some of them in some organisms are environmental. But we'll talk about some of the genetic cases. Some of them are really straightforward. Some of them are so complex. I'm going to show you a couple slides, start talking about it, give up, and then tell you it's not going to be on the test. Okay. So just a few terminologies, just so we're clear on this. Hermaphroditism is when both sexes are present in the same individual. It's fairly common in things like worms. So you can have two hermaphroditic organisms that can hook up in either possible combination of male-female, but they do not self-fertilize. That's one of the differences between a hermaphrodite and a monoecious organism. Monoecious organism would be plants are an example of that, where a plant that has both male and female, they can self-pollinate with the same plant. There doesn't have to be a second organism involved. Dioecious, you're either male or female, and you need two individuals involved. Okay. All right, so here are some of the genetic systems. The first one is the XXXO system. And if you are an XX, so we're talking about chromosomes here, that you have an X, 2X chromosomes would be XX. Only having one X chromosome is XO. There's not an O chromosome. O denotes the lack of an X. Okay? So XOs are male, XX are females. And the example of this are grasshoppers. So those of you who hang out with Doug Whitman, this one's all about you. Okay, and this is a fairly common system. In genetics, it's arguably the most common system of sex determination. It's the gene dosage of the X chromosome that determines gender on that. XXXY, we'll talk about this in a fair amount of detail today. This is what mammals do, including humans. If you have two X chromosomes, you're female. If you have an X and a Y chromosome, you're male. Oh, sorry, there's another bit of terminology I need to get to. Okay, the first one is autosome. When we talk about humans having 23 pairs of chromosomes, only one pair of those chromosomes is involved in sex determination. That's referred to as the sex chromosome. The other 22 pairs are referred to as autosomes. They have nothing to do with sex determination. Okay, so in mammals, the X and Y are the sex chromosomes. Yep?
Can you say the number for each of those?
Yeah, so humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes. 22 pairs are autosome. And one pair are sex chromosomes. And so actually these are numbered 1 through 22, and these are the X and Y chromosome. So if you've got two X chromosomes, you're female. If you've got an X and a Y chromosome, you're male. And we'll talk about how that plays out. Here we've got our nice shaded figures of a man and a woman again. And what happens during gamete formation is, remember, they're undergoing meiosis. They're going from 2N to 1N or diploid to haploid. And it's random as to which one of these chromosomes goes into which gamete. But one thing that happens is the eggs will always have an X chromosome. Okay. Mom has two X chromosomes, so when they separate, they're considered They're considered homologs during meiosis. So during meiosis one, the two X chromosomes are separated. But every egg will have an X chromosome in it. Mom's genetics have absolutely nothing to do with determining gender. Gender is determined entirely by what, which sperm fertilizes the egg. Because dad is X and Y, so dad can make two types of sperm. Dad can make sperm with an X or sperm with a Y chromosome. And a Y chromosome is much smaller. So there's actually some evidence that suggests that sperm with a Y chromosome can swim a little bit faster. They're carrying a little bit less weight. It's not much of an advantage. And it seems to change in the male's life. That earlier, the Y sperm seemed to have a bigger advantage than later in life. So there are labs that have looked at this. They're going back doing the epidemiology, looking at are men in their teens and 20s more likely to have sons than men who father children in their 50s and 60s. I think the evidence is a little dicey at the epidemiological level. Okay. But your gender was determined by which sex chromosome that sperm was carrying, because mom always donates an X. And so after fertilization, if it was a Y sperm, it will be a male. If it was an X sperm, it will be a female. All right, so this is, I told you that the sex chromosomes are considered homologs during meiosis. It's really easy to do when there are two X chromosomes, that they line up really well, they pair up, but the X chromosome is dramatically larger than the Y chromosome. And so during meiosis, when the homologs are lining up, how does that take place? There's actually a fair amount of genetic difference. There are different genes on the X chromosome than there are on the Y chromosome. So even just being held together by complementary DNA, which we'll talk about a lot later in the semester, that doesn't happen much. So what happens is at the ends of the chromosomes that there are these sequences called secondary pseudo-autosomal regions. And it's their job to, those are the structures that during meiosis one are used to determine that these two are in fact homologs, even though they don't look anything alike in the vast majority of them, that the identity at the ends is so similar that it forces the X and the Y chromosome to line up. If they didn't, in meiosis one, it would be tough to separate them. And if you don't separate the X and the Y, that's referred to as sex non-disjunction. You'll have an egg that could have an X and a Y in it, or you may have a sperm that's got both. That sperm's not going to swim well. But the egg is large enough that it could potentially carry an X and a Y. The other one wouldn't get any sex chromosome. Right? So it's important that even though the X and the Y don't look anything alike, they're different sizes, in meiosis one, we still need to get them lined up so we could pull them apart accurately. And that takes place as a result of those specialized sequences at the ends of the chromosome. I would have to be in a really pissy mood to have you guys spit that phrase back out to me on the exam. So just don't throw rotten tomatoes at me, and I can't imagine you'll have to. If you understand the general concept that there are specialized sequences at the ends of the X and the Y chromosome that allow them to align during meiosis, the concept is much more important than the $10 scientific phrase in my world. Okay. All right, so we'll revisit sex determination in humans and non-disjunction in a little bit. We're going to talk about some other systems. The ZZZW system, it's kind of like the XY, except in this case, the males are the homozygotes. Right? The males are the ones that have two copies of the same chromosome. So males are ZZ, and females have one copy of each in this, so they have a ZW. To be honest, I've never heard a good story as to why we went away from X's and Y's on this and went all Z's and W's. But this is another really common system. Reptiles use this. and some insects. The haploid diploidy system. This is most common in bees, would be the most common example of this, and that is it's not determined by a specific chromosome. It's determined by how many sets of chromosomes that you have. Okay. So in bees, the males or the drones, they're all haploid. That they are the product of there's no fertilization that takes place. It's basically a haploid egg is produced and it develops into a drone. And females are fertilized, result from fertilized eggs, so they're diploid. Okay? So it's not a specific sex chromosome, it's the number of sets with bees. Two sets, you're females, one set, you're male. So the interesting, this sets up an interesting situation in bees. So the females, they're showing a queen here, is diploid. So she goes through meiosis to produce her gamete. Right? Her eggs are haploid, so she has to carry out meiosis. The male, genetically, is haploid. He can't carry out meiosis. He's already down to one end. So male bees produce sperm by mitosis, not by meiosis. They still go through spermatogenesis to modify the cells, but male bees produce sperm by mitosis since they're already in haploid organism. And then if you get fertilization of an egg, you produce a female. And if you don't get fertilization of the egg, then it produces another male. And bees have this amazing ability to regulate their population, how many males are needed, how many females are needed. So the queen's pretty specific on how much fertilization she allows to take place. Okay. So there are some systems in which there's not a dedicated sex chromosome, but there are genes scattered throughout the genome that determine the sex, and the balance of those genes or the number of those copies of those genes is what's at play. That environmental sex determination comes into it. Temperature in organisms like turtles and alligators, that eggs are laid that are genetically the same, depending on the temperature at which they're incubated, the clutch of eggs will skew one direction towards more males or more females. So there's not a strict genetic determination of gender in these organisms. The one that your book likes is one, limpets. They're positioned in a stack. Limpets are a little bit like snails or barnacles. And what happens is they just will make a pig pile on top of each other, basically, where they keep expanding off of ones on the bottom. The ones on the bottom will tend to be females, that there are signals, chemical signals, that are a result of, look, I'm at the bottom of the pile. And the one that comes in on the top of the pile will exhibit male traits. And then as you get additional members, as the pile of limpets increases, one that started out as a male will switch to a female. And then the newer ones that are at the top of the heap will exhibit the maleness. So as this keeps going, you get a larger stack of females with some males on top of it. So an organism that started out its life in this pile as a female or as a male will end up as a female. So there's not a set gender for the entire life of a limpet. And you thought junior high was tough. Okay. Now there's some, this is the one that I will point to the slide, make a good faith effort, try to get the concept across to you, but don't obsess when you see all these numbers and ratios. Okay, you're not going to need to spit them back to me. But sex determination in fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, it's based on the ratio of the number of copies of chromosomes with the number of haploid sets of the autosomes. So it's a balance. How many copies of chromosomes do you have? How many of those are sex chromosomes? So you can get several different sex phenotypes in Drosophila. Okay. You can have just a regular female, regular male. With a female, you're looking at a ratio of 1 with the sex chromosomes to the autosomes. Okay. So if you get 2X chromosomes in with one set of the autosomes, you'll have a female. Males, you can have either XY or XO and be a male in fruit flies. And if you've got that with just one set of the autosomes, so you get a ratio of X to autosomes of 0.5, you're male. If you're carrying 2Xs and you still have a Y, it doesn't matter. You'll develop as female because that ratio of 2Xs to 2As is still going to be a 1-to-1 ratio. Right? So that's the ratio for female. You can get metafemales if you get up to a ratio of 1.5-to-1, where now you've got 3Xs instead of 2, but you still have the same number of autosomes. So more sex chromosomes than you have autosomes, and you develop slightly differently as a female, but you're still a female. But if you wind up someplace between 0.5 and 1, you're not really male, you're not really female. And if you wind up less than 0.5, you're a metamale. You're not quite male, but you're not close to female either. So it's all determined by the ratio of how many sex chromosomes you have to the number of autosomes that you have in fruit flies. And that's why we're not going to test over that. But I want you to understand that it's just, it's a gene copy or a chromosome copy effect. All right, so in humans, you are female by default if you're a human child. That you're developing in a female environment, right? Developing in mom's womb. Mom has, you know, especially during pregnancy, is flooded with female hormones. And by default, then, you develop as a female if there's no intervention of sex-determining genes in humans. It really comes down to one gene that determines maleness. And that gene's called the SRY gene. Guys, you understand that this just represents sorry, which you have to say to females for the rest of your life. So that's why we have that gene. Doesn't mean we're not right, though, but just say sorry and end it quicker. We're not always wrong, just often. So SRY is only on the Y chromosome. There should not be an SRY gene on an X chromosome. But occasionally that happens. When the X and the Y line up during meiosis 1, occasionally a really bizarre recombination event takes place and the SRY gene will make its way over to the X chromosome instead. And in that case, you get some unusual genetics. You'll get someone who develops like a female, but they have a Y chromosome. If it's the Y that fertilizes the egg because that Y chromosome no longer has the SRY gene. Or you can have somebody that develops as a male, but genetically they've got two X chromosomes, but one of those X chromosomes has the SRY gene on it. We'll talk about some other things that tie in with SRY, but SRY is a global regulator. Right? It just doesn't... It's not one protein that's produced that's a structural protein and all of a sudden, you know, you're a dude. It's a global regulator. So it's a protein that binds to DNA at multiple places in the genome. And it says there's a lot of genes involved with being a guy. And SRY is basically the brains behind that says, okay, not only to turn those genes on, but when to turn those genes on and what magnitude to express those genes. So it's one protein that's produced, but then it runs out and affects a lot of other genes that are expressed in maleness. Some of the most common, the book refers to them as aberrations. They're uncommon situations that pop up. They're genetic disorders. Turner syndrome is the most common with respect to sex chromosomes. It affects 1 in 3,000 females. And it's just a result of there's only one X chromosome. There's not a Y. There's not a second X. Okay. Since you're X by default, people with Turner's develop as female, but they just have slightly different body shapes. They tend to be a little bit shorter, a little bit stockier, a little bit thicker limbs. Sometimes they have a thicker neck than typical females. There's no real significant developmental effects in terms of mental capacity. Yep.
You said on the last slide that X is always going to be male because it's only a 0.5 or 2.
Oh, this is in humans now that we're talking about. This was in fruit flies.
Oh, that was fruit.
Okay. Yep. So we're back in humans now. Okay. Klinefelter's affects males, so you will have at least one Y in Klinefelter's, but you typically, the most common form of Klinefelter is XXY. So there's not separation of the sex chromosomes during meiosis one. And it's typically the egg that will carry two chromosomes, and then it's fertilized by a sperm with one chromosome, and now you've got three sex chromosomes. Okay, so you can get XXY. People with Klinefelter's typically aren't sterile, that they can reproduce. And so if you get somebody with Klinefelter's that reproduces, then their offspring can have even more sex chromosomes. They typically will have either two or three, but sometimes if you get somebody with Klinefelter's and they undergo non-disjunction where their sex chromosomes don't separate in meiosis, then you can start getting XXXY and XXXXY, and in some cases, XXYYs. But XXY is the most common by far. And the person with Klinefelter's develops as a male, but they have more delicate features. They tend to be taller, thinner. They have longer limbs. They don't put on as much muscle mass. But you would have no problems recognizing that they are a guy, but they're just a really elegant guy in many cases. Poly X females, this would just be like XXX or four X's. You still develop as a female for the most part. If you are poly X female, there's no real obvious difference that you would see from a distance. The problem comes in when they start making eggs. The number of X chromosomes that they produce becomes variable in each egg, and as a result, they're ability to have kids seems to be diminished from a woman that's XX. Yep. Oops. Yep.
When you had like the 1 out of 3,000, mm-hmm. Is that the chance of it happening?
Nope, that's the occurrence. So 1 out of 3,000 females has Turner. Okay. So the role of these chromosomes. The X chromosomes contain general genetic information that you need. Not everything on the X chromosome is involved in sex determination. There are a lot of just basic genes that are present on the X chromosome. But you need at least one copy of an X chromosome. There's not enough genetic information on a Y that if somebody, we talked about XO with Turner, they have no problems with viability that those fetuses will develop, but you can't be an OY and survive. You need at least one X chromosome, that there's essential information just to live on the X chromosome. The male, the SRY gene is present on the Y chromosome. There's some somewhat controversial research that's out there that there are some guys that are XYY and they're referred to in the old literature as super males. And it was speculated that having an extra Y chromosome, having two copies of SRY when you were developing, would result in a more male-like development. That at different points during development and adolescence, that you would have hormone balances that weren't quite the same as other males. It was followed up. They then went in and looked in the prisons. They did genetic testing on the general population, determined the average rate of XYYs, and they went into the prison population, looked at people in jail for violent crimes, looked at their DNA, and they found that there was a significant difference that people in jail for violent crimes tended to be XYY much more often than people in the general population. That since has been re-examined, and those numbers are not as dramatic. So we really don't know if being XYY makes you prone to getting in a bar fight or not. But developmentally, there are some traits associated with being XYY that are fairly consistent in terms of its ability to affect your behavior. That's less clear. But again, in the absence of a Y chromosome, you will develop as a female. And there is a SRY stands, not for sorry, but for sex determining region on the Y chromosome. Okay, so here's the Y chromosome. It's replicated. In this case, we've got two sister chromatids. And the SRY gene is near the short arm of the Y chromosome. It's actually getting awfully close to that area at the end of the chromosome that allows the X and the Y to line up. Okay? So it's a single locus that's present with the SRY gene. There's another set of genetic conditions in which you may develop looking like one gender when genetically you're not. Okay. So if there's a mutation, some people just get a mutation in the SRY gene, right? That the DNA is damaged in the sperm or early on when the egg is fertilized, and the SRY gene doesn't function, then you would have a Y chromosome but develop as female. Remember, you need a functional SRY gene for maleness. But one of the things that happens when the SRY gene is expressed, basically what happens is a fetus is developing and it comes time to start making the junk, and you get what will be the genitalia of the individual, and it's in sort of an ambiguous state. Saying, okay, I can be a penis or I can be a vagina at this point. I'm just waiting on the tap on the head to tell me we're going down the penis road. Otherwise, it's vagina town for us. Okay? And so this ambiguous genitalia is there. The cells are waiting. The cells have to move. They have to, you know, expand in volume to take on the different shapes, you know, of a penis or a vagina. And it's those signals that all of those genes that are affected by SRY. When SRY is expressed, it goes out, it binds to the DNA, all of those genes are turned on. Some of them send signals into those cells. It's like, all right, it looks like it's penis for us, and they start developing as a penis. Okay? If that SRY signal isn't sent, eventually what will happen is the cells will go, okay, we're waiting. We didn't get the penis signal. We're going to make a vagina. And so you're female by default for that reason. Yep. Okay, yep. But in some cases, what happens is if you have an SRY that is, it's expressed, but it's not expressed at the right levels, or if it's been mutated so it doesn't work at 100% capacity, you get this weak signal that's sent. And those cells are sitting there and they're going, okay, which one is it? Which one is it? Wait, did someone just tell us penis? I'm not sure. Did you hear penis? I didn't hear penis. I want to wait. And it's kind of, I don't know. And then they start to develop. They wait. They pause because they're getting weak signals instead of either a strong signal or no signal. And sometimes as a result of that, you get ambiguous genitalia in the individual, or genitalia that goes 2/3 of the way down that road, but it doesn't get all the way before birth. Okay? So in situations where there's a somebody in the Olympics that they keep gender testing her because she has somewhat ambiguous genitalia, that's how it results, is that SRY signal just isn't strong enough, or it's not absent. That sort of in-between land is not good for genitalia development. So now you got a story to tell your friends over lunch, I guess. But there's another. This is all done by hormones and classes of hormones called androgens. And if you remember from hopefully 197 or if you've had 203, hormones interact with receptors and they affect gene expression events. So hormones tend to be fat-based molecules. They travel long distances, they can, and they send signals to other cells to change their behavior. And these androgens are associated with gender. And in particular, we think about androgens being more male-based hormones in mammals. And so there's a disease called androgen insensitivity syndrome. And it could be that you've got hormones that are being produced at the right levels, but you don't have the receptors that interact with them. So you're sending the signal for maleness. Genetically, you're a male. Your body is doing everything that it can to, you know, produce muscles, have facial hair, do all that stuff, but that the antenna is broken. That signal is not being received at all. And what happens with these individuals is they tend to develop as, they're referred to as super females, because they tend to be taller than a regular female. They tend to be very slender, but they've got this odd combination that they're tall, they're slender, but they go through development of their secondary sex characteristics kind of late, but with a vengeance. So they're late bloomers, so they are relatively thin women with long angular necks and limbs with racks and hips. And so Hollywood loves them some super females. And so there are a lot of famous people that, rumor has it, have androgen insensitivity. And genetically, they're men. But to all the world, they look like females. But the result of being androgen insensitive also means that you tend to have ambiguous genitalia and you tend to be sterile. And so you are a tall, thin, lovely actress in Hollywood that can't have kids. You've got some unusual things going on down there, so it's tough to have long-term relationships with fairly stable people. And so you wind up for a short period of time marrying Tom Cruise or selling yogurt on TV because of its microbial content. Not mentioning any names, but they're out there. So, guys, if you're out in public, ask yourself, is she just a little too tall, a little too thin, and a little too developed? Could be. I don't know. Songs have been written about less. And those of you young ladies who are actually tall and thin and well-developed, you're welcome. I just thinned the herd for you. Okay, now, I mentioned that the X chromosome or the sex chromosomes aren't only involved in gender determination, that there are other traits encoded on those chromosomes. And we'll talk about some of those. First is you get different patterns of inheritance when we talk about genes that are encoded or alleles that are on sex chromosomes. Okay, when we've been talking about all this stuff up to now, it did not matter whether the organism we were talking about was male or female. With the autosomes, the ratios always pan out. When we start talking about alleles that are present on the X chromosome, the ratios start changing. And so this was determined in Drosophila that there's a gene that can cause white eyes. Sorry, this is really small, but I'm just talking about the example. You don't need to memorize all these. But what will happen is you're much more likely to get wide-eyed males than you are wide-eyed females. In humans, the example that we'll focus on most common is color blindness, red-green color blindness. The gene that produces the receptors that allow discerning red and green is present on the X chromosome. And in some individuals, that there's a mutation in that gene, and it doesn't allow them to distinguish red or green. Okay, so let's look at what's going on here. Remember, females have two copies of the chromosome, of the X chromosome. Males only have one copy. The normal color vision allele is dominant over the colorblind allele. If you've got a normal one, it will be able to mask that mutation of the colorblind gene. So you only need one copy of a normal color vision gene to be able to see red and green. Okay. So in females, what happens is if they get one copy of a colorblind gene and one copy of the normal one, they'll have normal color vision. If a male gets a single copy of the colorblind gene, he will be colorblind. He doesn't have that second X chromosome to have a chance to have a normal, or what we call a wild type version of that allele. So males are much more likely to express the recessive traits if it's a sex-linked gene. So if it's on the X chromosome, we refer to it as X-linked or sex-linked. Okay. So a female's got two versions. If she gets the dominant color and the recessive color, she'll still have normal vision. If the the black markers are just not good this year. It's not a good crop of black markers. Sorry, this is small. If the male gets a recessive, that this will be colorblind. This is normal color vision. This would be normal for a male, one copy of the normal allele. For a female to be colorblind, she has to get two copies of the mutant or the colorblind version of the gene, where males only have to get one. Okay. Yep?
How does it occur with the females if bar body comes up and swoops?
No, so what happens is, so his question is kind of beyond the point that we are right now. So developmentally, the determination of this, there tends to be very little mosaicism in eye development compared to the rest of the body. So they tend to develop based on this entire influence the whole time. If they do it here, it's not an either or. You get a small effect, but there's enough of the dominant later on to carry them through when it is mosaic. But the amount of mosaicism in eye development is limited. Okay. That'll make a little bit of sense to you guys in about 15 minutes. Okay. But for a female to be colorblind, right, dad has to be colorblind. Absolutely. Right? Because one of these X chromosomes is coming from dad. So that means dad had to have the colorblind gene on an X chromosome. Dad only has one X chromosome. So dad was X colorblind Y. So for a female to be colorblind, it means dad had to be colorblind. And mom could have normal color vision but be a heterozygote. Okay? Or mom could be colorblind as well. Okay? But it's so rare in females that that's generally not the case, unless maybe mom and dad met at a colorblind support group or something. But for the most part, it's mom doesn't know that she's got the colorblind gene. Dad does know because stoplights are a bitch. And then the female can be colorblind. It's much more common that you've got dad's not colorblind, mom's not colorblind, but mom has the, she's heterozygous. And then what will happen is boys will always get the Y from dad, so boys will get their X chromosome from mom all the time. So in this, half of the sons born to this couple will be colorblind, even though neither of the parents were. Okay? So with girls, if she's colorblind, dad had to be. With boys, it doesn't matter what dad was. Boys don't get an X chromosome from dad. With boys, it matters what mom had on her X chromosomes. So it's a different pattern of inheritance. Now all of a sudden, the gender of the person, which parent was affected, matters. Whereas all these other crosses we were talking about with genes that were on the autosomes as opposed to the sex chromosomes, it didn't matter. Later when we do some pedigrees, we'll talk about how those ratios play out. But the big take-home message is, for recessive traits that are X-linked, males exhibit the recessive phenotype much, much more often than do females, because they only need one copy of it to exhibit or express the recessive traits. Females need both copies of that gene to do it. Okay. When we start talking about gene regulation in the later parts of the class, there's a huge amount of molecular energy and effort that is exerted to make sure that you're expressing genes at just the right amount. And when we talk about expressing genes, we really mean a gene is expressed to produce a certain protein, and that certain protein is needed at a certain abundance within the cell. Okay? And so, as a rule of thumb, you've got two copies of an allele, and both copies are expressed, and they both result in the production of a certain amount of protein. But what happens with genes that are present on the X chromosome? You don't have typically a second copy of that gene on a Y chromosome in males. Okay? So you set up the stage where there's a potential for gene expression to be dramatically different in males and females for those genes that are on the X chromosome. And there are a couple of ways that you could adjust that situation. You could, if you've got a male, there could be a signal, okay, we're a male, we've got one copy of the X chromosome, every gene that's on here we need to make twice as much. Since we only have one copy of the gene, that gene has to work twice as hard. Okay. Or you could set up a situation in which we're female, we've got two copies of this, the males only have one, let's just shut down half. And we'll just go with one copy and express one copy of the genes. Okay? And that's what happens. It's the latter, that in human females, half the X chromosomes are shut down. And this is a slide showing the nucleus, showing some dense bodies. What happens is, these are really bad pictures. We'll talk about kitty cats in a minute. So what happens is, one of the two X chromosomes gets turned off. It gets basically wound up so tightly that those genes can't be accessed for information. Okay. So if you've got... you've got two chromosomes, one of them just becomes really dense, and that information can't be accessed. It's referred to as a bar body. Okay. So in that female cell, there is one copy of the X chromosome that's actually used. So your classmate's question was, when this happens, this X inactivation happens, if you've got a heterozygote for colorblindness, would they still have the ability to be colorblind if the ones with the dominant gene were inactivated? Okay? The thing is, this happens late enough in development that you've got quite a few cells And it's not fully, the female's not fully developed, but she's far enough along the road that the cells that will be the eye and the cells that will be, her left shoulder blade and all this stuff have there are enough of them there that it's sort of patchy, that there are patches of cells that will be inactivated, and they'll go ahead and develop more, so you'll have large areas that will have the same inactivation. Okay? And that's referred to as mosaicism, ex-mosaicism. Okay? And that is, you just have patches of a female's body in which one X is inactivated and other patches in which the other X is inactivated. It's a random event which X gets inactivated. Okay? But in a typical female cell, you have one X that will be in the normal state, the other will be inactivated as a bar body. In some of those cases where we had poly X females, they would have multiple bar bodies. So it's not just one X that gets inactivated, it's all the X's except for one get inactivated. So in somebody that was XXX, they would have two bar bodies in each cell and one functional X. So that's why being XXX is not that severe of a change. Okay? Now the example, a really obvious example of how that plays out, calico cats. The gene involved in coat expression, coat color, is present on the X chromosome. And if you get a heterozygote cat during development, the coat color, the orange or the black, is on the X chromosome. So if you get the X inactivated, that part of the cat will be orange. If you get the orange X that's inactivated, that part will be black. If you're a male, that's why you don't see male calico cats, because this coat pattern can only result from X inactivation, and X inactivation doesn't happen in males. So males will either be orange or black, but they won't be both on the same cat. So if you ever find a male calico cat, take it, put it in a box, take it someplace, have a press conference. Somebody will give you really good money for a male calico cat in the world. I don't know why they would want that. Maybe scientists want to study what the mechanism was, but you just don't see them. So that doesn't mean you ought to be going around your neighborhood and putting all the calico cats in a box until you determine what their gender is. But if you happen to stumble upon one, by the way, I'm not a big cat fan, so we won't have a lot of cat examples in here. My daughter sent me a picture yesterday that there was a cat looking in the back door of our deck, and I don't know if she wanted to show me because she thought it was a cute cat. I texted her back telling her where the Super Soaker and the Tabasco were. So I don't know how she resolved that problem. She tends to be a much nicer person than I am. So, and our beagle is far too old to actually chase a cat away. So, there are some Y-linked characteristics. There are some genes that are just found on the Y chromosome and not the X. So, hey guys, we got something too. And then you realize the most common example is hairy ears. And I don't mean regular hairy ears, that this is much more common in people of Middle Eastern and Mediterranean heritage. I'm talking about you're growing a full beard out of the inside of your ears, and it looks like dark cotton candy is trying to escape from your skull. So genetically, yeah, it's not good to have a Y chromosome genetically. There are inheritance patterns associated with male-associated traits. One of the things that males do, people always forget Darwin's second book. The first book was about evolution through natural selection, which is great. You got to live. If there are things out there picking you off in nature, that's not good. You don't have a lot of good chances to have offspring that will make it. If you're getting eaten by large birds. But the second book was about the role of sexual selection. It doesn't do you any good to live into your 20s if you're a human, if you got no chances of a date on Friday night ever for your life. Right? You could be the biggest, meanest, toughest guy, win all the fights, bring back all the food, if you can't find a lady friend. Okay? So, with male, some of the male-specific genes tend to be involved in mate attraction. And guys tend to do peacocking. If you, you know, mystery was right. So the example that they use here is actual feather patterns in peacocks. That males have to, in many species, males are the ones that attract the female, try to show her how impressive he is. And then she's like, wow, this guy can bring home food, beat up other males, and he's nice looking too. Let's have some little peahens. And so, big display traits of males showing how impressive and manly we are Y chromosomes. And apparently at one point in human evolution, ear hair was really an impressive trait for women. It's like, look at that tuft of hair coming out of that guy's ears. He can bring home the mastodon. So, all right. So remember that there's homework online. It shouldn't take you, if it's taking you more than 10 minutes, one of us has done something horribly, horribly wrong in this relationship. All right, so it's due first thing Tuesday. Have a good weekend. Those of you traveling, travel safely.
So why is it called Y-linked?
Because the gene is actually on the Y. Oh, sorry.